The jurors scattered for lunch and reconvened in the jury room at 1:15. In little pockets of whispered conversations, they talked about the case. They were surprised and confused, surprised that the trial had turned so abruptly against Letty Lang. Before Fritz Pickering showed up, the evidence was mounting, and it was becoming clear that Seth Hubbard was a man who did whatever he wanted and knew exactly what he was doing. That changed suddenly, and Letty was now viewed with great suspicion. Even the two black jurors, Michelle Still and Barb Gaston, appeared to be jumping ship. The confusion was about what was next. Who would Jake put on the stand to undo the damage? Could it be undone? And if they, the jurors, rejected the handwritten will, what would happen to all that money? There were many unanswered questions. There was so much chatter about the case that the foreman, Nevin Dark, felt compelled to remind them that his honor frowned on what they were doing. "Let's talk about something else," he said politely, not wanting to offend. He was not, after all, their boss. At 1:30, the bailiff entered the room, counted heads, and said, "Let's go." They followed him into the courtroom. When they were seated, all 12 looked at Letty Lang, who was not looking up from her note-taking. Nor did her lawyer glance over at the jury box for one of his cute little smiles. Instead, he sat low in his chair, chewing on a pencil, trying to appear relaxed. Judge Atlee said, "Mr. Lanier, you may call your next witness."
"Yes, sir."
"The contestants call Mr. Herschel Hubbard." He took the stand, smiled goofily at the jury, swore to tell the truth, then began answering a lot of mundane questions. Wade Lanier had groomed him well. Back and forth they went, covering all aspects of Herschel's uneventful life. As always, the spin was in, and Herschel recalled with great fondness his childhood, his parents, his sister, and the grand times they had all had together. Yes, the divorce was quite painful, but the family struggled through it and persevered. He and his old man were very close, talked all the time, saw each other whenever they could, but hey, both were living busy lives. Both were big fans of the Atlanta Braves. They followed the team religiously and talked about the games all the time. Letty stared at him, dumbfounded. She had never heard Seth Hubbard say one word about the Atlanta Braves, and she had never known him to watch a baseball game on television. They tried to make it to Atlanta at least once each season to catch some games. Say what? This was news to Jake and everyone else who had read Herschel's depositions. He had never mentioned such a road trip with his father. But there was little Jake could do. It would take 2 days of hard digging to prove the trips to Atlanta never took place. If Herschel wanted to invent tales about him and his old man, Jake couldn't stop him at this point. And Jake had to be careful. If he had any credibility left with the jury, he could seriously damage it by attacking Herschel. The man had lost his father. Then he'd been cut out of his will in a very cruel and humiliating manner. It would be easy and only natural for the jurors to feel sympathy. And how do you argue with a son who wasn't close to his father, but now swears that he was? You don't. And Jake knew it was an argument he could not win. He took notes, listened to the fiction, and tried to keep a poker face as if everything was going great. He could not bring himself to look at the jurors. There was a wall between him and them, something he'd never before experienced. When they finally got around to Seth's cancer, Herschel became somber and even choked back tears. "It was just awful," he said. watching this active and vigorous man dry up and shrivel with the disease. He had tried to quit smoking so many times. Father and son had engaged in long, heartfelt conversations about the smoking. Herschel quit when he was 30, and he begged his father to quit also. In his final months, Herschel visited him as often as possible. And yes, they talked about his estate. Seth was clear about his intentions. He might not have been too generous with Herschel and Ramona when they were younger, but he wanted them to have it all when he died. He assured them that he had prepared a proper will, one that would insulate them from financial worries and also secure the future for their children, Seth's beloved grandchildren. Seth was not himself toward the end. They talked all the time by phone, and at first Herschel noticed his father's memory was fading. He couldn't remember the score of last night's baseball game. He repeated himself constantly. He would ramble on about the World Series, though the Braves were not in the series last year. But to Seth, they were. The old guy was slipping away. It was so heartbreaking. Not surprisingly, Herschel was wary of Letty Lang. She did a fine job cleaning the house and cooking and caring for his father. But the longer she worked there, and the sicker Seth became, the more she seemed to protect him. She acted as though she didn't want Herschel and Ramona in the house. Several times Herschel called his father, but she said he wasn't feeling well and couldn't come to the phone. She tried to keep him away from his family. Letty glared at the witness, slowly shaking her head. It was quite a performance, and by the time it was over, Jake was almost too stunned to think or move. Through skillful and no doubt exhaustive preparation, Wade Lanier had pieced together a fictional narrative that any father and son would envy. Jake walked to the podium and asked, "Mr. Hubbard, on these trips to watch the Braves play, what hotel did you and your father usually stay in?" Herschel squinted and his mouth opened, but nothing came out. Hotels have records that can be checked. Finally, he recovered and said,
Well, we stayed in different hotels."
"Did you go to Atlanta last year?"
"No, Dad was too sick."
"The year before?"
"I think so, yes."
"Okay. So you went in 87. Which hotel?"
"I can't remember."
"All right. Who did the Braves play? Games and schedules are records that can be checked."
"Well, gee, I'm not sure, you know. Maybe it was the Cubs."
Jake said, "We can check on that. What was the date?"
"Oh, I'm terrible with dates."
"Okay. In 86, did y'all make it to Atlanta for a game or two?"
"I think so, yes."
"Which hotel?"
"Maybe the Hilton. Not sure."
"Who'd the Braves play?"
"Well, let's see. I can't be sure, but I know we saw them play the Phillies one year."
"In 86, who played third base for the Phillies?" Herschel swallowed hard and looked straight ahead, as if staring at headlights. His elbows were twitching, and he kept glancing at the jurors. His lying had caught up with him. Lanier's fictional masterpiece had holes in it. Finally,
"Don't know."
"You don't recall Mike Schmidt, the greatest third baseman in the game? He's still there and on his way to the Hall of Fame."
"Sorry, no."
"Who played center field for the Braves?" Another painful pause. It was obvious Herschel didn't have a clue. "Ever hear of Dale Murphy?"
"Sure, that's him. Dale Murphy."
For the moment, Herschel gave every indication of being a liar.
or at least a great embellisher. Jake could poke and prod around the rest of his testimony, but there was no guarantee he could score again. Instinctively, he decided to sit down. Ramona was next, and she was crying not long after she was sworn in. She still couldn't believe her beloved daddy had been so lost and distraught that he took his own life. With time, though, Lanier settled her down, and they plowed through their scripted testimony. She had always been daddy's girl, and she just couldn't get enough of the old guy. He adored her and her children and came to visit them often down in Jackson. Once again, Jake grudgingly admired Wade Lanier. He had prepared Ramona well for her deposition back in December and taught her the art of sandbagging. He knew that at trial, there was no way Jake could rebut her testimony, so offer a few crumbs during the deposition, just enough to vaguely answer the questions, then load up the fiction for the jury. Her testimony was a dramatic blend of emotion, bad acting, lying, and exaggerating. Jake began stealing glances at the jury to see if anyone was suspicious. As she bawled again, Tracy McMillan, number two, met Jake's look and frowned as if to say, "Can you believe this?" At least that was Jake's reading. He could be wrong. His instincts had been rattled, and he didn't fully trust them. Tracy was his favorite juror. Their eyes had been meeting for 2 days now, and things had been elevated almost to the point of flirting. It wasn't the first time Jake had used his good looks to win over a juror, nor would it be the last. Another glance over, and he caught Frank Doley shooting one of his patented, "I can't wait to burn you" looks. Wade Lanier wasn't perfect. He kept her on direct far too long and began to lose people. Her voice was grating, and her crying was a tired old act. Those watching suffered along with her, and when Lanier finally said, "I tender the witness," Judge Attlee quickly tapped the gavel and said, "Let's recess for 15 minutes. The jurors left, and the courtroom cleared out. Jake stayed at his table, as did Letty. It was time to acknowledge each other. Portia moved her chair closer, so the three of them could speak softly in a small huddle. Letty began with,
"Jake, I'm so sorry. What have I done?"
Her eyes were instantly wet.
"Why didn't you tell me, Letty? If I had known about the Pickerings, I could have been prepared." "It didn't happen that way at all, Jake. I swear I never discussed no will with Miss Irene. Never. Not before she wrote it, not after. I didn't even know about it until I came to work that morning, and all hell broke loose. I swear, Jake, you got to let me explain this to the jury. I can do it. I can make them believe me."
"It's not that simple. We'll talk about it later."
"We need to talk, Jake. Herschel and Ramona are lying through their teeth. Can't you make them stop?"
"I don't think the jury is buying much of this," Portia said.
"They don't like Ramona."
"I can understand that. I need to run to the restroom. Any word from Lucian?"
"No. I checked the phone messages during lunch. Some lawyers, some reporters, and one death threat."
"A what?"
"Some dude said they're going to burn your house again if you win all that money for them niggers."
"How nice. I sort of like it. It brings back fond memories of the Haley trial."
"I saved it. You want me to tell Ozzie?"
"Sure." Harry Rex caught Jake outside the restroom and said,
"Spoke with Chilcott. No deal. No interest in talking settlement. In fact, he almost laughed in my face. Said they have another surprise or two."
"What?" Jake asked in a panic. Well, of course he wouldn't tell me. That would ruin the ambush, right?
I can't take another ambush, Harry Rex.
Just keep you cool. You're doing fine.
I don't think Herschel and Ramona impressed too many jurors.
Should I go after her?
No. Take it easy. If you pin her down, she'll just start crying again. The jury's sick of her.
5 minutes later, Jake walked to the podium and said, "Now, Mrs. Defoe, your father died on October 2nd of last year, correct?"
"Yes."
"Before he died, when was the last time you saw him?"
"I didn't keep notes, Mr. Bagantz. He was my daddy."
"Isn't it true that you last saw him in late July, over 2 months before he died?"
"No, that's not true at all. I saw him all the time."
"The last time, Mrs. Defoe, when was the last time?"
"Again, I didn't keep up with the dates. Probably a couple of weeks before he died."
"Are you sure about that?"
"Well, no, I'm not positive. Do you make a note every time you visit your parents?"
"I'm not the witness, Mrs. Defoe. I'm the lawyer who's asking the questions. Are you sure you saw your father a couple of weeks before he died?"
"Well, I can't be positive."
"Thank you. Now, what about the children, Will and Leanne? When was the last time they saw their grandfather before he died?"
"Oh, heavens, Mr. Bagantz, I have no idea."
"But you testified they saw him all the time, right?"
"Of course, yes. They love their granddaddy."
"Did he love them?"
"He adored them."
Jake smiled and walked to the small table where the exhibits were kept. He picked up 2 sheets of paper and looked at Ramona. "This is the will your father wrote the day before he died. It's in evidence, and the jury has already seen it. In paragraph 6, your father writes, and I quote, 'I have 2 children, Herschel Hubbard and Ramona Hubbard Defoe, and they have children, though I don't know how many because I haven't seen them in some time,' end quote." Jake placed the will back on the table and asked, "By the way, how old is Will?"
14.
"And how old is Leanne?"
12.
"So it's been 12 years since you had a child."
"Yes, that's very true."
"And your own father didn't know if you'd had any more kids?"
"You can't believe that, Will, Mr. Bagantz. My daddy wasn't in his right mind when he wrote that."
"I guess that's up to the jury." No further questions. Jake sat down and got a note from Quince Lundy that read, "Brilliant. You killed her." At that moment in the trial, in his career, in his life for that matter, Jake needed a boost. He leaned over and whispered, "Thank you." Wade Lanier stood and said,
"Your Honor, the contestants call Mr. Ian Defoe, husband of Ramona Hubbard."
Ian slinked to the stand, no doubt primed and ready to fabricate another trip down memory lane. Halfway through his testimony, Quince Lundy slipped over another note. It read, "These people are trying way too hard to convince the jury. Don't think it's working." Jake nodded as he looked for an opening, a stray word that he might seize and turn against the witness. In the wake of his wife's over-the-top drama, Ian came across as harmlessly dull. He gave many of the same answers, but without the emotion. Through sources and back channels, Jake, Harry Rex, and Lucian had picked up some dirt on Ian. His marriage had been on the rocks for some time. He preferred to stay away from home and blamed his absences on business. He ran the women hard. His wife drank too much, and some of his deals were in trouble. On cross, Jake's first question was,
You say you're a commercial real estate developer, right?
That's correct.
Do you own all or part of a company called KLD Biloxi Group?
I do.
And is that company attempting to renovate the Gulf Coast Mall in Biloxi, Mississippi?
It is.
Would you say that company is financially sound?
Depends on how you define financially sound.
Okay. Let's define it like this. 2 months ago, was your company, KLD Biloxi Group, sued by the First Gulf Bank for the non-payment of a $2 million line of credit? Jake was holding and waving some papers clipped together. He had the proof.
Yes, but there's a lot more to the story.
I didn't ask for more. Was your company also sued last month by a New Orleans bank known as Picayune Trust for $2.6 million? Ian took a deep breath and finally said,
Yes, but these cases are still pending and we countersued.
Thank you. Nothing further. Ian stepped down at 4:45, and for a moment Judge Attlee considered recessing until Thursday morning. Wade Lanier offered to help by saying,
Judge, we can put on a witness that won't take long.
If Jake had an inkling of what was coming, he would have stalled some more with Ian, burned some clock, and dodged another ambush, at least until the next day. As it turned out, however, the jury left for the night with an even lower opinion of Seth Hubbard and his proclivities. Lanier said,
We call Julina Kidd.
Jake immediately recognized the name as one of the 45 Lanier had dumped on his desk 2 weeks earlier. Jake had tried twice to phone her, but got nowhere. She was fetched from a witness room and led to the witness stand by a bailiff. Per Wade Lanier's rather clear and firm instructions, she wore a cheap blue dress that was similar to what Letty had on. Nothing tight, nothing sexy, nothing to show off a figure that usually commanded a second look. No jewelry, nothing fancy. She tried her best to look plain, though that would have been impossible. The message was subtle. If Seth would chase this attractive black woman, then he would also chase Letty. She took the stand and smiled nervously at the jury. Lanier walked her through some preliminaries, then got right to the point. He handed her some paperwork and asked,
Can you please identify this?
She took a quick look and said,
Yes, this is a claim for sexual harassment I filed against Seth Hubbard about 5 years ago.
Jake was on his feet, practically yelling, Objection, Your Honor. Unless counsel can explain to us why this is relevant, it should not be admitted. Lanier was standing too, ready to rumble.
Oh, it's very relevant, Your Honor,
he said loudly. Judge Attlee raised both hands and said, Silence! He glanced at his watch, looked at the jurors, paused for a second, and said,
Let's keep everyone right here and take a 5-minute break. Counsel, meet me in chambers.
They hurriedly marched back into his chambers. Jake was bitter enough to throw a punch, and Lanier seemed willing to mix it up. When Lester Chilcott closed the door, Judge Attlee said,
What's her testimony?
Lanier said, She worked for one of Seth Hubbard's companies in South Georgia. They met there. He came on strong, forced her to have sex, then fired her when she decided she didn't want any more. They reached an out-of-court settlement on the harassment suit.
And this was 5 years ago? Jake asked.
It was.
How is it relevant to our issues today? Judge Attlee asked.
Oh, it's very relevant, Your Honor,
Lanier said casually and with the benefit of months of preparation. Jake was thoroughly blindsided and almost too angry to think. Lanier continued, It goes to the issue of undue influence. Ms. Kidd was an employee, as was Ms. Lang. Seth had a propensity to seduce women who worked for him, regardless of color. This weakness led him to make decisions that were not financially sound.
Jake?
Bullshit. First, Judge, she should not be allowed to testify because she was not listed as a witness until 2 weeks ago, in clear violation of the rules. Second, what Seth did 5 years ago has nothing to do with his testamentary capacity last October. And obviously, there is not one shred of proof that he was intimate with Letty Lang. I don't care how many women, black or white, he was screwing 5 years ago. Lanier said, "We think it's probative." Jake said, "Bullshit. Everything's probative."
"Your language, Jake," Judge Atlee warned.
"Sorry." Judge Atlee held up a hand, and all was quiet. He lit a pipe, exhaled mightily, paced to the window and back, then said,
"I like your point, Wade. Both women were his employees. I'll allow the testimony."
Jake said, "Who needs a rule book?"
"See me after court today, Jake,"
Judge Atlee said sternly, then blew some more smoke. He laid down his pipe and said,
"Let's carry on."
The lawyers reassembled in the courtroom. Portia leaned forward and whispered to Jake,
"What happened?"
"The judge has lost his mind, that's all."
Julina told her story to a breathless crowd. Her sudden promotion, the new passport, the trip to Mexico City with the boss, the luxury hotel with adjoining rooms, then the sex and the guilt. Back home, he fired her immediately and had her escorted out of the building. She sued, and Seth quickly settled out of court. The testimony was not relevant to the will contest. It was scandalous and certainly memorable, but as Jake listened to it, he became convinced Judge Atlee had blundered badly. The trial was lost, but the appeal was looking stronger by the hour. Jake would have a grand time exposing Wade Lanier's trickery to the Supreme Court of Mississippi. He would take great satisfaction in finally getting Reuben V. Atlee reversed. Jake admitted to himself that it was a lost cause if he was already thinking about the appeal. He quizzed Julina Kidd for a few minutes, just long enough to extract the admission that she was being paid to testify. She would not say how much. Lanier had obviously talked to her in time. "So, you swapped sex for money, and now it's testimony for money, right, Ms. Kidd?" he asked. It was a harsh question, and as soon as he uttered it, he wished he could take it back. She was only telling the truth. She shrugged, but didn't respond. Perhaps the classiest answer of the day. At 5:30, Judge Atlee adjourned until Thursday morning. Jake stayed in the courtroom until long after everyone had left. He chatted quietly with Portia and Letty, and tried in vain to assure them things were not as bad as they really were. It was a hopeless exercise. He finally left as Mr. Pate was turning off the lights. He did not stop by Judge Atlee's office as directed. Instead, he went home. He needed some quiet time with the two people he loved the most, the two who would always think of him as the greatest lawyer in the world. Chapter 45. The flight to Seattle was overbooked. Lucian got the last seat on one to San Francisco, where he would have 20 minutes to catch a nonstop to Chicago. If all went well, he would land in Memphis just after midnight. Nothing went well. He missed the connection in San Francisco, and while berating a ticket agent, almost got himself handcuffed by a security guard. To get him out of the airport, they put him on a shuttle to L.A. with the promise he'd get a better connection to Dallas. En route to L.A., he drank 3 double bourbons on ice and had the flight attendants glancing at each other. Upon landing, he went straight to a bar and continued drinking. He called Jake's office 4 times, but got only the recording. He called Harry Rex's 3 times, but was told the lawyer was in court. When the nonstop to Dallas was canceled at 7:30, he cursed another ticket agent and threatened to sue American Airlines. To get him out of the airport, they put him on a 4-hour flight to Atlanta, first class, with free drinks. Tully Still drove a forklift for a freight company in the industrial park north of town. He was working the night shift and easy to find. At 8:30 Wednesday night, Ozzie Walls gave him the nod, and they walked outside into the darkness. Still lit a cigarette. The two were not related, but their mothers had been best friends since elementary school. Tully's wife, Michelle, was juror number 3. Front row, dead center, Jake's prize.
"How bad is it?" Ozzie asked.
"Pretty bad. What happened? Things were rocking along fine, then the case blows up.
Couple of witnesses came out of nowhere. What are they saying in there?"
"Ozzie, even Michelle's got doubts about Letty Lang. The woman looks bad, man. Sneaking around, getting old white folks to change their wills. Michelle and the Gaston woman will stick with her, don't worry. But that means they got 2 votes. And the whites on the jury ain't bad people, maybe a couple. But most were going with Letty until this morning. It's not all black against white in there."
"So there's a lot of talk?"
"Didn't say that. I think there's a lot of whispering. Ain't that pretty normal? You can't expect folks not to say a word until the end."
"I suppose."
"What's Jay gonna do?"
"I'm not sure he can do anything. He says he's called his best witnesses.
Looks like he got blindsided, like those Jackson lawyers got the best of him."
"We'll see. Maybe it's not over."
"Looks bad.
Keep a lid on it."
"Don't worry."
They were not celebrating with champagne at the Sullivan firm, though fine wine was being poured. Walter Sullivan, the retired partner who founded the firm 45 years earlier, was a connoisseur who had recently discovered fine Italian Barolos. After a light working dinner in the conference room, he pulled some corks, brought in some fine crystal goblets, and a tasting came to life. The mood was nothing short of triumphant. Myron Pankey had watched 1,000 juries and had never seen one flip so quickly and so thoroughly.
"You own them, Wade," he said.
Lanier was being revered as a courtroom magician, able to pull rabbits out of hats in spite of the rules of evidence.
"Give the judge the credit," he said modestly, and more than once. "He just wants a fair trial."
"Trials are not about fairness, Wade," Mr. Sullivan chided. "Trials are about winning."
Lanier and Chilcott could almost smell the money. 80% of the gross estate for their clients, less taxes and so forth, and their little 10-man litigation firm would net a fee in excess of $2 million. It could arrive quickly. After the handwritten will was declared void, they would move on to the prior will. The bulk of the money was in cash. A lengthy probate might be avoided. Herschel was in Memphis, commuting to the trial with his 2 children. The Defoe family was staying in the guest house of a friend near the country club. All were in fine spirits and eager to get the money and get on with their lives. After he finished his wine, Wade would call them and receive their accolades. An hour after he spoke to Tully Still, Ozzie was leaning on the hood of his patrol car in front of Jake's house, smoking a cigar with his favorite lawyer.
Ozzie was saying,
Tully says it's 10-2.
Jake puffed and said, No real surprise there.
Well, it looks like it's time to fold up your chair and go home, Jake. This little party's over. Get something for Letty and get the hell out. She don't need much. Settle this damn thing before it goes to the jury.
We're trying, Ozzie, okay? Harry Rex approached Lanier's guys twice this afternoon. They laughed at him. You can't settle a case when the other side is laughing at you. I'd take $1 million right now.
$1 million? How many black folk around here got $1 million, Jake? You thinking too much like a white man. Get $500,000. Get a quarter. Hell, get something.
We'll try again tomorrow. I'll see how the morning goes, then approach Wade Lanier during lunch. He knows the score, and he obviously knows how to play the game. He's been in my shoes before. I think I can talk to him.
Talk fast, Jake, and get out of this damn trial. You won't know part of this jury. This ain't nothing like Haley.
No, it's not. Jake thanked him and went inside. Carla was already in bed reading and worrying about her husband. What was that all about? She asked as he undressed. Just Ozzie. He's concerned about the trial. Why is Ozzie out roaming around at this hour? You know Ozzie. He never sleeps. Jake fell across the end of the bed and rubbed her legs under the sheets.
Neither do you. Can I ask you something? Here you are in the middle of another big trial. You haven't slept 4 hours in the past week, and when you are asleep, you fidget and have nightmares. You're not eating well. You're losing weight. You're preoccupied, off in la-la land half the time. You're stressed out, jumpy, testy, sometimes even nauseous. You'll wake up in the morning with a knot in your stomach. The question? Why in the world do you want to be a trial lawyer?
This might not be the best time to ask that question.
No, it's the perfect time. How many jury trials have you had in the last 10 years?
31.
And you've lost sleep and weight during each one, right?
I don't think so. Most are not quite this significant, Carla.
This is exceptional. My point is that trial work is so stressful. Why do you want to do it?
Because I love it. It's what being a lawyer is all about. Being in the courtroom in front of a jury is like being in the arena or on the field. The competition is fierce. The stakes are high. The gamesmanship is intense. There will be a winner and a loser. There is a rush of adrenaline each time the jury is led in and seated.
A lot of ego.
A ton. You'll never meet a successful trial lawyer without an ego. It's a requirement. You got to have the ego to want the work.
You should do well, then.
Okay, I admit I have the ego. But it might get crushed this week. It might need soothing.
Now or later?
Now.
It's been 8 days. Lock the door.
Lucian blacked out somewhere over Mississippi at 35,000 feet. When the plane landed in Atlanta, the flight attendants helped him off. Two guards put him in a wheelchair and rolled him to the gate for the flight to Memphis. They passed several airport lounges, all of which he noticed. When the guards parked him, he thanked them, then got up and staggered to the nearest bar and ordered a beer. He was cutting back, being responsible. He slept from Atlanta to Memphis, landing there at 7:10 a.m. They dragged him off the plane, called security, and security called the police. Portia took the call at the office. Jake was upstairs frantically reviewing witness statements when she buzzed through with,
Jake, it's a collect call from Lucian.
Where is he?
Don't know,
but he sounds awful.
Take the call and put him through. Seconds later, Jake picked up the receiver and said, Lucian, where are you? With great effort, he was able to convey the message that he was in the Memphis City jail and needed Jake to come get him. He was thick-tongued, erratic, obviously bombed. Sadly, Jake had heard it all before. He was suddenly angry and unsympathetic.
They won't let me talk,
Lucian mumbled, barely intelligible. Then he seemed to be growling at someone in the background. Jake could visualize it perfectly. He said, Lucian, we're leaving in 5 minutes for the courtroom. I'm sorry. But he wasn't sorry at all. Let him rot in jail.
I gotta get there, Jake. It's important,
he said. His words slurred so badly that he repeated himself 3 times. What's important?
I got deposition. Ansel's. Ansel Hubbard. Deposition. It's important, Jake.
Jake and Portia hurried across the street and entered the courthouse through the rear doors. Ozzie was in the hallway on the first floor talking to a janitor. Got a minute? Jake asked with a look that was dead serious. 10 minutes later, Ozzie and Marshall Prather left town in a sprint to Memphis.
Missed you yesterday, Judge Attlee said when Jake entered his chambers.
The lawyers were gathering for the morning's pregame briefing.
Sorry, Judge, but I got tied up with trial details, Jake replied. I'm sure you did. Gentlemen, any preliminary matters this morning?
The lawyers for the contestants smiled grimly and shook their heads. No. Jake said,
Well, yes, Your Honor, there is one matter. We have located Ansel Hubbard in Juneau, Alaska. He is alive and well and unable to rush down here for the trial. He is an interested party to these proceedings and should be included. Therefore, I move for a mistrial and suggest we start over when Ansel can be here.
Motion denied, Judge Attlee said without hesitation. He would be of no assistance in determining the validity of this will.
How did you find him?
It's quite a long story, Your Honor.
Save it for later. Anything else?
Not from me.
Are your next witnesses ready, Mr. Lanier?
They are.
Then let's proceed.
With the juror so deeply in his pocket, the last thing Wade Lanier wanted to do was to bore them. He had made the decision to streamline his case and get to the jury as soon as possible. He and Lester Chilcott had mapped out the rest of the trial. They would spend Thursday calling their remaining witnesses. If Jake had anything left, he would then be permitted to call rebuttal witnesses. Both lawyers would deliver their closing arguments mid-morning on Friday, and the jurors would get the case just after lunch. With the weekend looming, and with their minds already made up, they should finish and deliver a verdict long before the courthouse closed at 5. Wade and Lester would be in Jackson in time for a late dinner with their wives. As seasoned lawyers, they should have known better than to plan the rest of the trial. Their first witness Thursday morning was a retired oncologist from Jackson, a Dr. Swaney. For decades, he had worked as a practicing physician while teaching at the medical school. His resume was impeccable, as were his manners, and he spoke with a deep backcountry drawl that carried no pretensions. He was thoroughly credible and believable. Using as few medical terms as possible, Dr. Swaney explained to the jury the type of cancer that was killing Seth Hubbard, with emphasis on the tumors that metastasized to his spinal cord and ribs. He described the intense pain involved with such tumors. He had treated hundreds of patients with a similar condition, and it created some of the worst pain imaginable. Demerol
was certainly one of the most effective drugs available. An oral dosage of 100 milligrams every 3 to 4 hours was not uncommon and would alleviate some of the pain. It usually rendered the patient drowsy, sluggish, dizzy, often nauseous, and unable to carry out many routine functions. Driving was certainly out of the question, and obviously important decisions should never be made while under the influence of that much Demerol. As a younger lawyer, Jake had learned the futility of arguing with a true expert. A bogus expert often provided the opportunity for some real carnage before the jury, but not so with witnesses like Dr. Swaney. On cross, Jake made it clear that Seth Hubbard's own treating physician, Dr. Talbert, was not certain how much Demerol Seth was taking in the days before his death. The witness agreed it was all speculation, but politely reminded Jake that patients rarely buy more of an expensive drug if they're not using it. The next expert was another medical doctor, a Dr. Niehoff from the medical school at UCLA. Small-town juries are easily impressed with experts who travel great distances to spend time with them, and no one knew this better than Wade Lanier. An expert from Tupelo would have their attention, while one from Memphis would be even more believable. But bring in the same guy from California, and the jury would hang on every word. For $10,000 of Wade Lanier's money, plus expenses, Dr. Niehoff explained to the jury that he had spent the last 25 years researching and treating pain in cancer victims. He was well acquainted with the tumors under discussion and did a thorough job of describing their effects on the body. He had seen patients cry and scream for prolonged periods of time, turn deathly pale, vomit uncontrollably, beg for medications, pass out, and even beg for death. Thoughts of suicide were quite common. Actual suicide was not rare. Demerol was one of the more popular and effective treatments. Here Dr. Niehoff ventured off script when he lapsed into a bit of technical jargon, as happened so often when experts couldn't resist the temptation to impress their listeners. He referred to the drug as meperidine hydrochloride, said it was a narcotic analgesic, an opiate pain reliever. Lanier stopped him and brought his vocabulary back in line. Dr. Niehoff told the jury that Demerol was a powerful pain reliever and highly addictive. He had worked with the drug for his entire career and had written numerous articles about it. Doctors prefer to dispense it in the hospital or in their clinics. However, in a case like Seth Hubbard's, it was not unusual to allow the patient to take it orally at home. The drug was easy to abuse, especially for a person in severe pain like Seth. Jake rose and said, "Objection, Your Honor. There is not a shred of evidence that Seth Hubbard abused this drug." "Sustained. Stick with the facts, Doctor." Jake sat down, relieved to have finally received a favorable ruling on something. Dr. Niehoff was an excellent witness. His descriptions of the tumors, the pain, and the Demerol were detailed, and after 45 minutes on the stand, it was easy to believe Seth was suffering greatly, and his pain was relieved only by massive doses of Demerol, a drug that practically knocked him out. In his expert opinion, Seth Hubbard's judgment was so adversely affected by the daily dosages and cumulative effects of the drug that he could not have been thinking clearly in his final days. On cross, Jake lost even more ground. When he tried to make the point that Dr. Niehoff had no idea how much of the drug Seth was taking, the expert guaranteed Jake that anyone suffering like Seth would be desperate for Demerol. If he had access to a prescription, then he was taking the pills, Mr. Brigance. After a few more pointless questions, Jake sat down. The two doctors had accomplished precisely what Wade Lanier had intended. At that moment, in the minds of the jurors and practically everyone else in the courtroom, Seth had been disoriented, dizzy, drowsy, lightheaded, and unable to drive, so he asked Letty to do it. In summary, he lacked testamentary capacity. After a 10-minute recess, Lanier continued when he called Lewis McGuire as a witness. Because the Rush firm had made such an ungraceful exit from the case and was thus cut out of the fees, McGuire at first refused to testify. So Wade Lanier did the unthinkable. He subpoenaed another lawyer. In short order, Lanier established that McGuire had prepared a thick will for Seth in September 1987. That will was admitted into evidence, and McGuire stepped down. As much as he wanted to hang around and watch the trial, his pride wouldn't allow it. He and Stillman Rush hurried from the courtroom. Duff McLennan took the stand, took the oath, and proceeded to explain to the jury that he was a tax lawyer with a 300-man firm in Atlanta. For the past 30 years, he had specialized in estate planning. He drafted wills, thick ones, for wealthy people who wanted to avoid as much of the death taxes as possible. He had reviewed the inventory of assets filed by Quince Lundy, and he had reviewed the handwritten will signed by Seth Hubbard. Lanier then flashed onto a large screen a series of calculations, and McLennan launched into a windy explanation of how federal and state death taxes gobbled up the unprotected estate. He apologized for the intricacies, the contradictions, the mind-numbing banalities of our dear tax code, and apologized for its complexities. Twice he said, "I didn't write this. Congress did." Lanier knew perfectly well that the jury would be bored, if not repulsed, by this testimony, so he labored diligently to skip along, hitting the high points and leaving much of the code in the dust. Jake was not about to object and prolong this agony. The jurors were already antsy. When McLennan mercifully got to the bottom line, he said, "In my opinion, the total tax bill, state and federal, will be 51%. On the screen in bold letters, Lanier wrote, $12,240,000 in taxes. But the fun was just starting. McLennan had analyzed the will prepared by Lewis McGuire. It was primarily a collection of related and complicated trusts that gave $1 million outright to Herschel and Ramona each, then tied up the remainder for many years while doling it out to the family. He and Lanier had no choice but to discuss it in detail. Jake watched the jurors as they began to nod off. Even McLennan's light version of what the will was intended to do was dense and at times comically impenetrable. Lanier, though, was on a mission. He plowed ahead and began running the numbers on the big screen. The bottom line was that the tax bill under the 1987 will would be, in McLennan's expert opinion, only $9,100,000, state and federal, give or take a few bucks. The difference of $3,140,000 was printed in bold numbers on the screen. The point was well made. Seth's hastily written holographic will cost his estate a lot of money. More proof he was not thinking clearly. Jake had learned to avoid the IRS code in law school, and for the past 10 years had readily stiff-armed any potential client looking for tax advice. He had none to offer because he knew so little about that area of the law. When Lanier tendered the witness,
Jake passed. He knew the jurors were bored and ready for lunch.
"We'll be in recess until 1:30, Judge Antley said. Mr. Brigance?
Jake planned to grab Wade Lanier and ask if he had 5 minutes to chat, but his plans were suddenly changed. He met Judge Antley in his office down the hall. After His Honor removed his robe and lit his pipe, he sat down, stared at Jake, and calmly said,
"You're not pleased with my rulings."
Jake snorted and said, "No, I am not. You've allowed Wade Lanier to hijack this trial with a couple of dirty tricks, a couple of surprise witnesses that I had no chance to prepare for."
"But your client lied."
"She's not my client. The estate is my client. But yes, Letty was not truthful. She was caught off guard, Judge, ambushed. In her deposition, she clearly stated she could not remember all the White families she had worked for. The Pickering episode was so unpleasant, I'm sure she tried to forget it. And the most important aspect of that little story is that Letty never knew about the handwritten will. I could have prepared her, Judge. That's my point. I could have softened the impact. You, though, allowed an ambush, and the trial flipped in a matter of seconds." Jake glared at the old man as he spoke, though he was well aware that Reuben V. Atlee was not one to be reprimanded. But this time, the judge was wrong, and Jake was angry at the injustice. He had nothing to lose at this point, so why not lay it all on the table? The judge puffed and seemed to eat the smoke. Then it drifted out.
"I disagree. Regardless, though, I expect you to maintain your dignity. Lawyers do not curse in my chambers."
"My apologies. I sometimes curse in the heat of the battle. Doubt if I'm the only one. I'm not sure the jury has flipped, as you say." Jake hesitated. He almost reminded the judge that he knew almost nothing about juries. He so rarely saw them, which was part of the problem. In Chancery Court, he ruled supreme as judge and jury and had the luxury of admitting all evidence. He could sift through it, separate the good from the bad, and issue a ruling he deemed fair. Jake was not about to argue. Instead, he said, "Judge, I have a lot of work to do." Judge Antley waved at the door, and Jake left. Harry Rex caught him as he was leaving the courthouse and said,
"Ozzie called the office, said they're still at the jail in Memphis and trying to get him out. Right now they can't get a bond set."
Jake frowned and said, "A bond? For what?"
"He's charged with public drunkenness and resisting arrest."
"It's Memphis.
They throw in the resisting charge every time they haul someone in." "I thought Ozzie had contacts there."
"I guess he's looking for them. I told you it was a mistake to send that drunk to Alaska."
"Is this really helpful right now?"
"No." "What are you doing for lunch?"
"I'm not hungry."
"Let's get a beer."
"No, Harry Rex. Some juries get offended when the lawyer reeks of alcohol."
"You're not still worried about this jury, are you?"
"Knock it off, would you?"
"I got to go to court in Smithfield this afternoon. Good luck. I'll check in later."
"Thanks." As Jake crossed the street to his office, he realized that Harry Rex had not missed a word in the courtroom since Monday morning. Dwayne Squire was the vice president of Baring Lumber Company. On the Thursday before the suicide, he and Seth had engaged in a disagreement over a large shipment of heart pine to a flooring company in Texas. Squire had negotiated the deal and was surprised to learn that his boss then called the company and negotiated another deal at a lower price. Back and forth they went throughout that Thursday morning. Both men were upset, both convinced they were right. But at some point, Squire realized that Seth was not himself. Arlene Trotter was out of the office and missed the conflict.
At one point, Squire entered Seth's office and found him with his head in his hands, claiming to be dizzy and nauseous. They spoke later, and Seth had forgotten the details of the contract. He claimed Squire had negotiated a price that was too low, and they argued again. By the time Seth left around 3 p.m., the deal was done, and Baring would eventually lose about $10,000. To Squire's recollection, it was the largest loss on any customer contract Seth was ever involved in. He described his boss as being disoriented and erratic. The following morning, he sold the timberland in South Carolina for a substantial loss. Jake was well aware that Wade Lanier was pushing hard now and trying to get the case to the jury before the weekend. Jake needed to stall. So on cross-examination, he pulled out the Baring financials and walked Squire through them. 1988 was the most profitable year of the last five, though revenues dipped in the last quarter after Seth's death. As the jurors faded away, Jake and Squire talked about the company's performance, its contracts, strategies, costs, labor problems, plant depreciation. Twice His Honor said, "Move along, Mr. Brigance." But he didn't push too hard. Mr. Brigance was already unhappy with him. After Duane Squire, Lanier called to the stand a Mr. Dewberry, a land broker who specialized in farms and hunting clubs. He told the story of dealing with Seth in the days before he died. Seth had been interested in buying 500 acres in Tyler County for a hunting club. He and Dewberry had been looking at land for the past 5 years, but Seth would never pull the trigger. He finally paid for a one-year option on the 500 acres, then got sick and lost interest. As the option was about to expire, he called Dewberry several times. Dewberry did not know Seth was dying, nor did he have any idea he was on painkillers. One day, Seth wanted to exercise the option. The next day, he did not. Several times, he could not remember the price per acre, and on one occasion, forgot who he was talking to on the phone. His behavior became more and more erratic. On cross, Jake managed to stall even more. By late Thursday afternoon, the trial had ground to a near halt, and Judge Attlee adjourned early. Chapter 46. After butting heads with the Memphis bureaucracy, Ozzie was about to quit when he remembered something he should have thought of sooner. He phoned Booker Sistrunk, whose office was four blocks from the city jail. After a rough beginning, the two had kept in touch, and over the months had visited on two occasions when Ozzie was in Memphis. Booker had not been back to Clanton and wasn't keen to return. Both realized that two black men, living 60 minutes apart and with some measure of power in a white world, should find common ground. They should be friends. Of particular interest to Booker was the fact that he still had $55,000 on loan to the Langs, and he wanted to protect his money. The Memphis police loathed Booker Sistrunk, but they were also afraid of him. 15 minutes after he arrived in his black Rolls, paperwork was hopping from one desk to another, with Lucian Wilbanks a high priority. He walked out 30 minutes after Booker walked in. "We need to go to the airport," Lucian said. Ozzie thanked Booker and promised to catch up later. As the story unfolded, Lucian had left his briefcase on the airplane. He thought it was under the seat, but it could have been in the overhead compartment. Regardless, the flight attendants were idiots for not finding it. They were much too concerned with dragging him off the airplane. Ozzie and Prather listened and fumed as they raced to the airport. Lucian looked and smelled like a Skid Row bum they had picked up for vagrancy.
Americans Lost and Found had no record of a briefcase being turned in on the flight from Atlanta. Reluctantly, the lone clerk began the task of trying to find it. Lucian found an airport lounge and ordered a pint of ale. Ozzie and Prather had a bad buffet lunch on a busy concourse not far from the lounge. They were trying to keep an eye on their passenger. They called Jake's office, but there was no answer. It was almost 3 p.m., and he was obviously tied up in court. The briefcase was located in Minneapolis. Because Ozzie and Prather were law enforcement officers, American was by then treating the briefcase as if it were valuable evidence and crucial to an important investigation, when in reality, it was a battered old leather bag with a few notepads, some magazines, some cheap soap and matches taken from the Glacier Inn in Juneau, and one video cassette tape. After a lot of uncertainty and haggling, a plan was put into place to route it back to Memphis as soon as possible. If all went well, it would arrive around midnight. Ozzie thanked the clerk and went to find Lucian. As they were leaving the airport, Lucian came to life and said,
"Say, my car is here. I'll just meet you guys in Clanton."
Ozzie said,
"No, Lucian, you're drunk. You cannot drive."
Lucian angrily replied,
"Ozzie, we're in Memphis, and you got no jurisdiction here. Kiss my ass. I'll do any damn thing I want to do."
Ozzie threw up his hands and walked away with Prather. They tried to follow Lucian as they left Memphis at rush hour, but couldn't keep up with the dirty little Porsche, as he weaved dangerously through heavy traffic. They drove on to Clanton, to Jake's office, and arrived there just before 7. Jake was waiting for the debriefing. The only slightly good news in an otherwise dreadful and frustrating day was Lucian's arrest for public drunkenness and resisting arrest. It would kill any talk of a possible reinstatement to the practice of law. But at the moment, that was small satisfaction, something Jake could not even mention. Other than that, things were as grim as they could possibly be. 2 hours later, Jake drove to Lucian's house. As he pulled into the driveway, he noticed the Porsche wasn't there. He spoke briefly to Sally on the front porch, and she promised to call as soon as he came home. Miraculously, Lucian's briefcase arrived in Memphis at midnight. Deputy Willie Hastings picked it up and drove to Clanton. At 7:30 Friday morning, Jake, Harry Rex, and Ozzie gathered in the conference room downstairs and locked the door. Jake inserted the cassette into his video recorder and turned down the lights. The words "Juneau, Alaska, April 5th, 1989, appeared on the television screen, then disappeared after a few seconds. Jared Wolkowitz introduced himself and explained what they were doing. Lucian introduced himself and said that this was a deposition and he would be asking the questions. He looked clear-eyed, sober. He introduced Ansel F. Hubbard, who was sworn in by the court reporter. Small, frail, his head as slick as a white onion, he was wearing Lucian's black suit and white shirt, both several sizes too big. There was a bandage on the back of his head, and a strip of the adhesive tape holding it was barely visible above his right ear. He swallowed hard, looked at the camera as if in terror, then said,
"My name is Ansel F. Hubbard. I live in Juneau, Alaska, but I was born in Ford County, Mississippi, on August 1st, 1922. My father was Cleon Hubbard, my mother Sarah Bell, my brother Seth. Seth was 5 years older than me. I was born on the family farm near Palmyra. I left home when I was 16. And never went back. Never. Never wanted to.
Here's my story. When the screen went blank 58 minutes later, the three men sat for a while and stared at it. It was not something they ever wanted to see or hear again. But that would not be the case. Finally, slowly, Jake rose and pushed the eject button.
We'd better go see the judge.
Can you get it admitted?
Ozzie asked.
No way in hell, Harry Rex said. I can think of 10 different ways to keep it out, and not a single way to get it in.
All we can do is try, Jake said. He raced across the street, his heart pounding, his mind spinning. The other lawyers were milling around the courtroom, happy it was Friday, and eager to get home with a major win under their belts. Jake spoke briefly to Judge Attlee and said it was urgent the lawyers meet in his office down the hall, where there was a television and a VCR. When they were assembled there, around the table, and when His Honor had filled and lit his pipe, Jake explained what he was doing. The deposition was given 2 days ago. Lucian was there and asked some questions.
Didn't know he was a lawyer again, Wade Lanier said.
Hang on, Jake said dismissively. Let's watch the tape, then we can fight.
How long is it? Asked the judge.
About an hour. Lanier said,
This is a waste of time, Judge. You can't admit this deposition if I wasn't there and didn't have the chance to examine the witness. This is absurd.
Jake said, We have time, Your Honor. What's the rush? Judge Attlee puffed away. He looked at Jake and, with a twinkle in his eye, said,
Play it.
For Jake, the second time through the video was just as gut-grinding as the first. Things he wasn't sure he heard right the first time were confirmed. He glanced repeatedly at Wade Lanier, whose indignation wore off as the story overwhelmed him. By the end, he seemed deflated. All of the lawyers for the contestants had been transformed. Their cockiness had vanished. When Jake removed the tape, Judge Attlee kept staring at the blank screen. He relit his pipe and exhaled a gust of smoke.
Mr. Lanier?
Well, Judge, it's patently inadmissible. I wasn't there. I didn't have the chance to examine or cross-examine the witness. Not really fair, you know, Jake blurted. So it's in keeping with the spirit of this trial. A surprise witness here, an ambush there. I thought you understood these tricks, Wade.
I'll ignore that. It's not a proper deposition, Judge,
Jake said. But what could you ask him? He's describing events that happened before you were born, and he's the only surviving witness. It would be impossible for you to cross-examine him. You know nothing about what happened. Lanier said, It's not properly certified by the court reporter. That lawyer in Alaska is not licensed to practice in Mississippi. I could go on and on. Fine. I'll withdraw it as a deposition and offer it as an affidavit. A statement given by a witness sworn before a notary public. The court reporter was also a notary public. Lanier said, It has nothing to do with Seth Hubbard's testamentary capacity on October 1st of last year. Jake countered, Oh, I think it explains everything, Wade. It proves without a doubt that Seth Hubbard knew exactly what he was doing. Come on, Judge. You're letting everything else in for the jury to hear.
That's enough, Judge Attlee said sternly.
He closed his eyes and seemed to meditate for a moment. He breathed deeply as his pipe went out. When he opened his eyes, he said,
Gentlemen, I think the jury should meet
Ansel Hubbard. 10 minutes later, court was called to order. The jury was brought in, and the large screen was set up again. Judge Attlee apologized to the jurors for the delay, then explained what was happening. He looked at the contestants' table and said, "Mr. Lanier, do you have any more witnesses?" Lanier rose as if crippled by arthritis and said, "No, we rest." "Mr. Brigance?" "Your Honor, I would like to recall Ms. Letty Lang for limited purposes. It will just take a moment." "Very well. Ms. Lang, please remember that you have already been sworn and are still under oath." Portia leaned forward and whispered, "Jake, what are you doing?" "Not now," he whispered. "You'll see." With her last visit to the witness stand still a horrible memory, Letty settled herself in and tried to appear calm. She refused to look at the jurors. There had been no time to prepare her. She had no idea what was coming. Jake began, "Letty, who was your mother? Your biological mother?" Letty smiled, nodded, understood, and said,
"Her name was Lois Rhines."
"And who were her parents?"
"Sylvester and Esther Rhines."
"What do you know about Sylvester Rhines?"
"He died in 1930, so I never met him. He lived on some land that the Hubbards now own. After he died, Esther signed the land over to Seth Hubbard's father. Sylvester's father was a man named Solomon Rhines, who also owned the land before him."
"No further questions, Your Honor. Mr. Lanier?" Wade walked to the podium without notes. "Ms. Lang, have you ever had a birth certificate?"
"No, sir."
"And your mother died when you were 3 years old, correct?"
"Correct."
"When we took your deposition in December, the week before Christmas, you were not so sure about your ancestry. What makes you so sure now?"
"I've met some of my kinfolk. A lot of questions have been answered."
"And you're certain now?"
"I know who I am, Mr. Lanier. I'm certain of that."
He sat down, and Judge Attlee addressed the courtroom. "At this time, we will watch the videotape deposition of Ansel Hubbard. Let's dim the lights. I want the doors locked and no traffic. This will take about an hour, and there will be no interruptions."